You know, even if you don't like people, we're all called to love people. And, you know, you may not like them, but you should love them. And I promise you, if you love people, if you help them solve their problems, everybody will come to you. Everybody will come to you.
Hello and welcome to Outer Spaces, a podcast dedicated to empowering designers and contractors in the outdoor living space. I am on a mission to scour the globe to find and interview the most brilliant mindset coaches, sales strategists, and business leaders alive, and present them in a way that landscapers, hardscapers, and outdoor living pros can immediately put them into use to grow and thrive. On Outer Spaces, we are passionate about breaking the chains of small mindsets and helping contractors just like you take control of their businesses and their lives. My name is Joshua Gillo, and through my 27 years of dirt under the nails experience, I look forward to sharing tips, strategies, and other contractor success stories here on the Outer Spaces podcast. Now, let's get on with the show. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Outer Spaces podcast. It's your host, Joshua Gillo, and this week we have Terry Tucker on. He's a former hostage negotiator, and he's just a really cool guy, and we talk a lot through how he got into that field, and how the same things he learned to negotiate hostage situations, life and death situations that we can use when it comes to communicating to other people, whether it's through sales or through any other kind of interaction, there's certain key fundamental principles that we need to know when we're communicating with another human being to end up having the best result for us both. So guys, if you struggle out there to communicate with people or are just really interested in what hostage negotiation is all about, listen in. Hey, Terry, I'm so excited to have you here on the show. And, you know, you wrote a book that really interests me. It's all about excellence, right? And you have really an amazing story, too, to go with this. So I'm excited to have you on the show this week, get deep into what excellence is, how to achieve it, and more importantly, how to sustain it. So, Terry, welcome to the show.
Joshua, thanks for having me on. I'm really looking forward to talking with you today.
Yeah, me too, dude. So let's just jump right into it, right? So what is excellence?
The answer to that question is, I don't know. you're like, you write the book and you're like, what do you mean you don't know? I look at excellence kind of like I look at beauty. It's sort of in the eye of the beholder. It's something that you have to determine the way you feel about it. I mean, you and I may look at a play, at a movie, at a sports team, you know, and you may say, they are great. They're excellent. And I may say, I think they're good, but I'm not sure they're excellent. So excellence, I think, really is something that each individual has to determine for their own selves. Now, once you determine that, how do you get it? How do you sustain it? And I think you see this all the time. You know, people work their butt off. They love the grind. They love getting into doing all this stuff. It's not about how much money I can make or you know, it's what I'm doing. I love the work. The end result is great, but it takes care of itself. So how do you sustain that? People work really hard, and then they get to the top of the mountain. And then what do most people do? They kind of sit back in their chair, put their feet up on the desk, pour themselves a drink, be like, I've arrived. And then 6 months, a year later, boom, somebody passes them up. They're like, whoa, what happened? What happened is you didn't sustain that excellence. You didn't find a new way to innovate. You didn't find a new customer base. You didn't find new things to do. If you're doing the same old thing over and over and over again, people are smart. They're going to study you and figure out how you got to the top of the mountain. And then they're going to apply their knowledge to it and say, okay, I can do what he did. And then I can take it to the next level, to the next step. And that's how people get past you. That's how people move up the mountain themselves. So you have to sustain it by constantly innovating, by constantly growing, by constantly finding new markets, new things, new products to sell. And if you do that, there's a chance you can sustain it. I mean, nothing's guaranteed in life. And I think, you know, really it's all about people saying, how much do I love the work and how can I make this better and how much can I add value to my customers?
100%. You know, it's also doing a deeper work throughout this process, or hopefully before, but throughout this process of quantifying what success even means.
Yeah.
Right? To your point, if the goal is to make $1 million and once you have that in your bank account, I'm done. I reached the top of the mountain. I'm good to go. I'm going to kick back. That's great if that's what you want. That's amazing. But deep down inside, especially of our masculine souls, right? We need to conquer something. We need a battle to be fighting. We need something that we can continually keep pouring into and keep basically checking ourselves to keep answering the question, do we have what it takes, and have to constantly just keep moving that forward, right? So, you know, when it comes to not knowing what success looks like or is quantified, if you don't have that clearly defined on what that looks like for yourself in different categories of your life, then you're going to constantly be struggling for something, striving for something, possibly looking for excellence in something, but not know why. Reach the top of that mountain and look across and see another mountain and be like, oh crap, I don't know if I want to do that. Right. So it's understanding that part, you know, is also a very important part here. So when it comes to excellence, and I know, I love how you said that. I love how you said, you know, look, it could be anything, just like beauty. One person would look at a car and be like, that thing looks horrible. Next one's like, oh my God, I would spend every dollar I have on that thing. Right. It is that. So excellence is totally up to the person, but it's understanding what that is for you and quantifying it, just like success, to know what it is. And when you reach it, what's next?
It is. But I think the real important thing, and actually I just wrote an article about podcasting, and there's a podcaster by the name of Ryan Hawk, who I listen to, Learning Leaders. And he wrote a book, and I read his book, and he was talking about, people will ask me, hey, will you help me develop my podcast? And he said, my first question to them is, why do you want to do a podcast? Kind of like you said, how do you define excellence? Why do you want to do this? And he said, if they tell me because I want to get more customers, or I want to have better marketing, or because I want to speak on bigger stages, he said, I know absolutely 100% that podcast will never be successful. He said, because it's not about the end game. It's about the grind. It's about the work. Yes. I love doing the work. The end game, success, excellence will take care of itself if you love doing the work. And I think that's where people fall down. It's like, I want to make $1 million. Well, it's here you are right now. I want to make $1 million. That's great. All this void between there, how do you get there? And if the answer is, I love the work that I'm doing. I love being a contractor. I love, you know, being an athlete. I love being a broadcaster, a podcast, whatever it is. I love the work. And if you love the work, excellence will take care of itself.
I love that. Terry, you couldn't have said it better, because so many think it's the goal that we're after. It's not. Yeah. It's the people we have to become in the journey to achieve that goal.
Yeah.
Write that one down, guys, because that's what it's about. It's finding a grind that you can get into, a mundane task possibly that you can do over and over again. You know, even podcasting, we're up to like over 150 episodes now when we first started, right? I was like, why did I start a podcast? I started it because I wasn't very good at speaking. To be fully honest with you, I wasn't good at speaking. I said, well, how can I constantly keep grinding this wheel? How can I constantly keep doing the work? Especially when I don't want to, because there's times when I have guests on that I'm just like, I'm done for the day, man. I've got like 400 burning fires I need to manage, right? And I'm like, no, I've already allotted the time. They've already given me their time. We're going to have a great podcast, right? And have to switch hats and switch gears and go from deep thought and conversation to something else, to something else, to something else, to become better at that. So I started a podcast so I could learn how to speak more fluidly, because I used to think in bullet points. And I would speak in bullet points, right? So how do you stitch them all together? How do you work on tonalities and highs and lows and all of that stuff? So when I'm learning it in a book, I can use it here. So this is the grind for me, right? So I get to meet awesome people like yourself and have amazing conversations and learn how to articulate. And then I can take that into the rest of the world, and maybe it gets you on a stage. Maybe there is some successes in the future, but the grind is what I'm after, even though there's many days that I don't want to do it.
Right. But that's just it. If you don't love the grind, when those days occur, you're like, you'll find something else to do. Oh, you know, I'm going to sit on the couch and watch TV, or I'm going to read a book, or I'm going to go for a walk. Yeah. But I'm not going to do the grind, because I'm not motivated to do the grind. Yeah. And if you're not motivated, you don't have the discipline, and you don't have those good habits. That's how I kind of define the grind. You know, motivation comes from within. You have to have good habits with that motivation, and then you have to have the discipline to implement those habits. If you don't have any one of those three, incredibly difficult to be successful in life.
No doubt. And discipline, I think, is the number one, right? Because it's doing it when you don't want to. Yep. It's going out for that run. It's lifting those weights. It's having that conversation when you don't want to, but you have the discipline knowing that, no, this is what I said I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it now, whether I want to or not. Once you do that over and over again, and I'm not speaking to you, Terry, I'm speaking to the guests, right? It's like, once you constantly keep the promises that you make to yourself and you're disciplined enough to do that. I mean, yesterday for us was Christmas, right? And I definitely had way too many sweets, and I had a couple of glasses of wine. I got up this morning and I wasn't feeling that great, right? And I didn't have a hangover or anything, but I just didn't feel that great.
And then I looked at my wife, she looked at me, it's like, it's time to work out. I'm like, let's do it. And it wasn't one thing I enjoyed about that workout. But at the end, I'm like, you know what? I said I was going to do it and it's done, right? It sets the entire tone for the rest of the day. So it's that discipline, the deeper discipline is really what keeps you on track, and having those daily rituals is what's going to keep you, pull you through the storms for sure.
It is. And I love the quote from Jerry Rice, the San Francisco 49er Hall of Fame receiver, who said, "Today I will do what others won't so that tomorrow I can do what others can't."
Yes.
And I think that just encapsulates what you just said. I'm going to get up and I'm going to work out today. All those people who did the same thing you did on Christmas, nah, I'm going to hit the snooze button. And I read an article recently that actually kind of scared me. It said that 33% of Americans, so a third of the population, admit to hitting the snooze button at least three times every morning. Wow. So think about, from your perspective, how much, how excellent can you be when you know at least a third of the population isn't getting out of bed when the alarm goes off? Just get out of bed when the alarm goes off and you'll be so much further ahead than those 33% of the country.
Wow. I mean, there's a lot we could say, spend a whole hour on a podcast just about alarm clocks, right? But you set the intent before, right? You set the discipline. I'm getting up at 5 o'clock, and then it comes. And then on the average of 33% of people hit the snooze button three times, it's like, well, were you really committed? Do you really have the discipline to do this? Because now it sounds like the little bitch is coming out. And that's the, but that little bitch is what keeps you in bed, and is what keeps you from everything you want in life, because he keeps coming out first and he wins. Yeah. And he wins. It's like, you know, giving a dog food at the table and then wonder why it keeps coming back for food. It's like, no. When you train them a certain way, you train yourself, you train that little inner bitch, you know, and that you're willing to do that. That's not cool. So the question would be, how do we change that? So maybe you set your alarm for a different time. Maybe you put the alarm on the other side of the room so you can't hit the button without getting out of bed already. Maybe you take a cold shower in the morning. That's going to be even tougher to get if you can't get out of an alarm clock. But I'm saying, like, you start your day out that way, shock yourself awake. Or you get like a daylight alarm clock. Have you ever seen those sunrise alarm clocks?
I have.
My wife has one. Yeah, it's great. The light comes on a little bit before, and then it comes on with birds and all that kind of stuff, so you're not shocked awake.
Right.
And, you know, I've been a guy most of my life that has not really needed an alarm clock. I'm just an early riser. Too. It's never been an issue. Sometimes I get up and I'm like, man, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. My body's like, or God's like, it's time to go, dude. Time to go. Right. So get up, like, all right, well, it's apparently something I got to do this morning. Let's get up and get going. Right. Just start the whole grind early. And, my point is, though, you know, if you're not getting up, maybe it's a lack of purpose that's holding you in bed in the morning. Maybe there's not something you got to get up and do. I know God's put gifts in all of us, and it's our job to discover them and to share them. And once you get closer to either discovering them or you have, getting up, it's a lot easier, because you're like, I don't want to lose another hour because I know why I'm here. I know what I need to do. So that's where excellence becomes a lot easier, because you know, you're driven from within.
You are. And I think you hit the nail on the head. If you know, I get this question sometimes, you know, how do you know if you found your purpose? Well, if you can't wait to get out of bed in the morning and go do it, there's a good chance that you have found that purpose, versus if you're one of those people that's hitting the snooze button, you know, three times every morning, that may not be your purpose. And that's okay. And I think you make a good point. A lot of times we try, and this would be great if it worked, but we feel like we have to align our job with our purpose. Mm. And that doesn't have to be the case. I mean, our job could be something we do over here to pay the bills, but our purpose is over here, and whatever that is, you know, to be a podcast host, to write books, to paint, to whatever, to be an activist, whatever you want to do, but whatever is in your heart. I always say this, especially when I speak to young people. If there's something in your heart, something in your soul that you believe you're supposed to do, but it scares you, go ahead and do it. Because at the end of your life, the things that you're going to regret are not going to be the things you did. They're going to be those things you didn't do. And by then it's going to be too late to go back and do them.
Amen, brother. Preach it on. That's exactly right. Because when you see that fear, that means you're just inches from what you really need to learn. Right? You're just inches from that. And your mind is just trying to hold you back, because deep down it wants to keep you controlled. And once you realize that those control factors aren't even real, they're all just imaginary, you're like, wait a minute here. So I didn't think I could run a mile. I just did. I didn't think I could run a marathon. I just did. Right? Because once you do that, then you go back in that cookie jar when you're not feeling like walking or running. You're like, dude, I ran a marathon. Like, this is chump change. Like, or I can't do a push-up. And then you do 50 push-ups. And you're like, why am I struggling with two? I did 50 already. So you start challenging yourself like that and you start becoming more and more confident in that. So anyway, I'm sure we'll go down some more of these rabbit holes, Terry. So tell us a little bit about yourself here for the listeners to find out exactly who they're listening to.
So I grew up on the south side of Chicago. I'm the oldest of three boys. You can't tell this from looking at me or from my voice, but I'm 6'8" tall and actually played college basketball at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina, despite having three knee surgeries in high school. When I graduated from college, I was actually the first person in my family to graduate from college. I moved home to find a job because I'm really going to date myself. This was long before the internet was available to help people find employment. But I was able to find that first job in the marketing department at the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International, the hamburger chain. That was the good news. The bad news was I lived with my parents for the next 3.5 years as I helped my mother care for my father and my grandmother, who were both dying of different forms of cancer. Professional, as I said, started out at Wendy's, and then I made a pivot in my life. I went to work for the hospital that took care of my father and my grandmother, kind of in a marketing role. And then I made a huge pivot in my life in my late 30s and became a police officer. That was really what I felt my purpose in life was. One of the things I did in law enforcement was I was a SWAT team hostage negotiator. After law enforcement, I started a school security consulting business, coached girls high school basketball, became an author in 2020. But for the last 11 and a half years now, I've been battling a rare form of cancer, a rare form of melanoma. And then just finally, my wife and I have been married for 30 years. We have one child, a daughter, who's a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy and is an officer in the new branch of the military, the Space Force.
Wow. Okay. I don't know where to start unpacking that.
You're a rabbit hole, right?
Oh, goodness. Wow. So, yeah, you're right. Before we started shooting, I was like, man, you definitely got a lot of stuff that you've done. And you're like, well, that's what happens with age. You start accumulating these things, right?
You get old.
You get old, but I love it. So 6'8", I would never know, but that's pretty cool. What I thought was really interesting, I mean, many things, the whole hostage negotiation side of things, that seemed like one heck of a pivot. So tell me how you got into that and how that, you know, with marketing or your background, how you became very good at that.
Well, there is a backstory. And so my resume doesn't look like a Super Bowl went off in the room, you know, and it's kind of all over the place. I'll give you the backstory real quickly. My grandfather, my dad's father, was a Chicago police officer from 1924 to 1954 and was actually shot in the line of duty with his own gun. It was not a serious injury. He was shot in the ankle. But my dad, who was an infant at the time, always remembered the stories my grandmother told of that knock on the door of, Mrs. Tucker, grab your son, come with us. I mean, let's face it, trauma medicine in 1933 when he was shot is a whole lot different than trauma medicine in 2023. Yeah. So when I expressed an interest in following in my grandfather's footsteps, my dad was absolutely not. You're going to college. You're going to major in business. You're going to get out, get a great job, get married, have 2.4 kids and live happily ever after. Mm-hmm. But that's the life my father wanted me to live. That's not the life I felt I was supposed to live. And as I mentioned, when I graduated from college, my dad was dying. So I had really one of the first major choices in my life. I could have said, sorry, Dad, I know you're dying, but I'm going to go blaze my own trail. Or out of love and respect for you, I will do what you want me to do. So understanding the backstory, I went into business because that's what my father wanted me to do. Yeah. As we talked earlier, I didn't feel it was my purpose. I you know, wasn't like, I can't wait to get out of bed. I learned a lot, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't my purpose. And I sort of joke, I did what every good son did. I waited till my father passed away and followed my own dreams. And that dream was getting into law enforcement. And I was a 37-year-old rookie police officer, which by most accounts is pretty old to be getting into that line of work. But the part of, you know, of getting on SWAT is I've always in my life wanted to be associated or be part of the best. Mm-hmm. And usually in a police department or a sheriff's department, the SWAT team are usually the best officers with the best training and the best equipment. So when there was an opening to be a negotiator, I put in for it. And I had to, you know, I had to do the physical fitness standards. I had to meet with the psychologist. I had to take psychological exams. And then I had to meet with the team. And it was an all or nothing thing. If one person on the team said, you know, yeah, I've worked with Terry before. I don't really like him. He doesn't have a good whatever. You didn't get on the team. So everybody had to give you the thumbs up. And fortunately, I was able to get that thumbs up. And that started a 4.5-year career as a SWAT negotiator.
That's incredible. I read the book Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss, and it comes to mind when I saw that. I was thinking, like, man, this is going to be like having Chris Voss on the show. This is going to be great.
Not even close. I mean, he's forgotten more than I'll ever know. So,
so how was it being a negotiator? I mean, there's high stakes in that. So, like, how do you manage the mindset around that pressure? Because when we're out there, you know, selling, communicating to people, we're selling backyards or doing whatever. Where here, you're actually, it's life and death on the line. So how do you manage that part, and how do you train for that?
Yeah, the way we trained was scenario-based. We had a psychologist that worked with us, and so we would just make up things or things we'd read about, and we would do a scenario. And where we learned was in the debrief. You know, you might get the question from the psychologist, did you ever think that person might be schizophrenic and off their medication? Oh no, I never thought about that. And so there was just constant learning. And I'll never forget when I first started as a negotiator, they gave us a formula of how we communicate. And it's not just negotiators or people that are barricaded. It's all of us. This is how we negotiate with each other. And the formula was 7, 38, 55. So 7% of how we negotiate with each other, or how we communicate with each other, is the words that we use. And think how we agonize over words and things like that. That's only 7% of how you communicate. And then 38% is the tone of voice that you use with those words. And then 55% of how you communicate a message is your body language and your facial expressions.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, as negotiators, you know, if somebody's barricaded with a gun, we're not in the room with them trying to negotiate. We're blocks away, and we can't see them. So I didn't have the luxury of saying something, because there were a lot of times we were negotiating with, we had no idea why we were here, no idea what started this. All we know is this guy's barricaded with a gun and he's taking shots. And so we would go down a rabbit hole, and it would be like, I didn't have the luxury of, you know, if I was negotiating with you, Josh, and, you know, I said something and you were, oh God, what an idiot. I can't believe Terry said that to me. I didn't have that luxury.
Yeah, yeah.
So we had to figure out what people were saying, certainly, or what people were thinking, or why we were there, based on what they were saying, what they weren't saying, and how they were saying it. So that was a big part of how we communicated and negotiated with people.
That's incredible, because we, you know, do a lot of phone work too with people, and we like to get them on Zoom so we can see expressions, so we can read body language, because you're right, now you get the full picture. But imagine life or death situation listeners, and you've got to do it all on tonality of voice, maybe over a phone, you can't see the person. So it becomes a very tricky way to do it, but I'm sure it's a skill that obviously can be learned, right? And I'm assuming you were highly effective at it. So it was, you know, one of those things where it can be learned. So do you have any stories of any negotiations that you did? Obviously, we're not going to use names, but any stories that come to mind about, you know, using this at like a high level?
Yeah, I'll give you kind of a funny one, and then I'll give you more kind of how it normally went. The funny one is, I was working this particular night. We were not a full-time SWAT team. Again, I'm going to date myself. We carried pagers. So when the pager went off, you would get a message on where to go and things like that. I was working that night. I was in a marked car in a uniform. I got to the scene fairly quickly. And I'm talking to the uniform officers on scene. I'm like, what's the deal? He's drunk. He's got a gun. He's barricaded himself in his house with his wife. I'm like, okay, do you have him on the phone? He said, yes, we do. I said, okay, let me talk to him. So we start talking. And Josh, it usually was hours before into the conversation before you would start talking about solutions. Because the way we used to negotiate, think about this, we were all kids, you know, we'd go to the park, we'd play on the teeter-totter or the seesaw.
Yeah.
And when we started negotiating, the person's emotional brain was way up in the air and their rational brain was way down on the ground. So over time, asking certain questions, we asked how and what questions, tried to stay away from why questions. They sound accusatory. We would try to get that teeter-totter to where their rational brain was up in the air and their emotional brain was down on the ground, because we make better decisions with our rational brain than we do with our emotional brain. Mm. So I've got this guy, and we're 10, 15 minutes in the conversation, but I just had a gut feeling. And so I said to him, what would it take for you to come out? And there was like dead silence for a few seconds. And he said, give me a beer. And I was like, I said, if I gave you a beer, do I have your word that you would let your wife go and you would come out peacefully? He said, do I have your word I could drink it? I said, you absolutely have my word you could drink the beer. And he said, then you have my word, I'd let my wife go. So I gave $5 and one of the uniform guys said, go down to the store, get a beer. Tactical team put it on the front porch. I call him back. I'm like, your beer's on the front porch, but you don't get it until your wife comes out safely and you come out with your hands up. And he asked me again, do I have your word that I can drink it? I said, you absolutely have my word. All of a sudden, the front door flies open. Here comes his wife. Here he comes with his hands up. We handcuff him, let him drink his beer, and off to jail he went. So that was a totally atypical negotiation. Didn't happen like this. This one is a lot more serious and more along the lines of why we were doing what we were doing. This is an individual, probably 7, 8 o'clock at night, decides he wants to kill himself. And he slits his wrists. Well, that doesn't work. And for some reason, he got this brilliant idea that turning the gas on his oven and sticking his head in the oven was an effective way to kill yourself. Well, that didn't work either. Then he calls his cousin. And his cousin had the forethought to call the police. And so we end up getting there, and I'm talking to him. And it's probably 3-4 o'clock in the morning now. And he's exhausted, but he's got a gun now. And he's like, Terry, I want to come out. I said, yeah, come on out. And I'll come down to the scene, and we'll talk face-to-face. We'll talk like men. Because sometimes you got to play to that, you know, it's man-to-man kind of thing. And he's like, I'd really like that. I said, take the phone with you, put the gun down, do what the tactical team tells you. I kind of set him up for what was going to happen. He hangs the phone up, which is not uncommon because we're conditioned that when a conversation's over, we hang the phone up. About 30 seconds later, one of the tactical officers comes on the radio and says, we heard a gunshot. And I thought, you didn't. He did. He shot himself in the head. But he shot himself at such an angle that the bullet went in underneath his skin at his temple, went around his scalp, basically never penetrated his skull or his brain, and came out the other side. Incredibly bloody, but in terms of seriousness, not very serious at all. So, you know, we talk about when it's your time, it's your time. But when it's not your time, it's not your time. No matter what you do, wow. If God doesn't want you, you're not going.
That's right. Wow. How to even make a bullet do that's incredible. In 3 different attempts, right?
Yes, exactly. 3 different times.
Crazy, crazy. And people are crazy. So I'd love to take this where, you know, obviously negotiating with people for their life or for the safety of others is one thing. Now, how do you take that hostage negotiation skill and bring it back into business or back into marketing or just communication in general? Like, I know there's connectiveness here. I'd love to hear how would you utilize what you've learned there?
I think a couple things. You know, as I mentioned before, we never used to ask why questions because they sound accusatory. So if you're negotiating with somebody, you know, it's like, well, why did you do that, Joshua? Oh, wait a minute. Is he accusing me? You know, that I can get to the same information with a what question. Well, Josh, what got us to this point? I can get that same information with. So that was one thing. Another thing is the most powerful tool you have as a negotiator is your voice. Yeah. And how you use that voice. And we were always taught to remain curious. So always, you know, when somebody would say something, we would use our curious voice and kind of, oh, really? Well, tell me about that some more. Yeah. And what we're trying to do, if you think about it, in any relationship, whether it's parent, child, boss, subordinate, you know, client, you're trying to sell somebody something, whatever it is, the overarching theme is trust. Do I trust you? Yeah. And how do you develop trust? You develop trust by gaining an understanding. We used to call it tactical empathy. Mm-hmm. Help me to understand where you're coming from. Maybe not necessarily agree. If I was negotiating with somebody who just murdered 3 people, I wasn't going to agree with what you did. Yeah. But help me to understand where you're coming from. Because if I can understand it, that understanding builds trust, builds empathy. And by oh, Terry gets me. Terry, okay, now all of a sudden, you and I have a relationship. And like I said, as negotiators, I didn't even know this person. You know, if you and I are negotiating for, you know, a backyard or something like that, that you're going to put in for me, well, we have a relationship. I'm talking to you. We've set this up. So that's important, the tactical empathy part of it. And another part of it is mirroring. So what we would do is we would let the person talk, and then we would take either the most important 2 or 3 words they said or the last 2 or 3 words they said and just parrot it back to them. And then go silent, be quiet. And I know it doesn't seem like I can do that because I talk a lot, but I mean, the silence is really where it's at.
Yeah.
And so being quiet, again, it's going to get you to start talking more because we don't like silence. And the more you talk, the more information I get. And if I can get you to divulge to me what your problems are, what your issues are, what you really want, then I can frame my sales or whatever it ends up being. I can frame what I'm selling you as a way to solve your problem. And I'll say this. We used to always say, no deal is better than a bad deal. And a deal is only, you only get a yes from people if there's some kind of attachment to it with how we're going to do it. People love to say no. So use that. You wouldn't be opposed to having a call today, would you, Josh? That's a different way of saying, hey, do you have time to talk now?
Yeah.
Flip it around to the negative. It lets them say no. We want to say no because no is safe. Yeah. So if you kind of flip that around, I mean, we could go on for hours and I can tell a bunch more stuff, but that's kind of, that's some of the things that I think can help you as a business person in terms of communicating with, but remember that 7:38:55, because that's so important of how we communicate with each other.
That's so true. It's so true. And, you know, I love that you spun that full circle and came all the way back around about communication and sales as well, because all those negotiating tactics that you're talking about that, tactical empathy and all of that, even parroting and mirroring and all of that is so useful. Let's put it that way. In sales, when you understand what it is and you're doing it, not reacting to a client, but going in there with an actual plan, you're responding, right? Or you're listening, you're doing it to your point. They're going to be listening to your tonality of your voice. So if you're constantly talking like this really, really fast, and you're like, you're looking all over the place and they're like looking at you thinking like, why is this guy not calm? He's probably done this before. Maybe this is his first time, right? So, but when you're calm, collected, you answer, you ask how and what questions, love that, right? Constantly asking those questions. Next thing the client's like, wait a minute here. And you're curious, like, all right, Mrs. Jones, tell me a little bit more about why you think that that patio should be out in the side yard. Or what about that side yard position? Do you think it's best for this, right? You just keep framing, moving it around, right? And then next thing you know, she's like, huh, I don't know. My grandson said it'd be kind of cool to have it over there. Well, okay, cool. Totally get that. So, you know, just think about it. It's a Thursday night, whole family's over, and you want to go all the way out to that spot to start a fire and have the whole family out there. What are the preparations you need to have in order to do that? Well, I want to make sure I got all my s'mores material together for the grandkids. And I want to make sure I have my chair and a blanket because it always gets cold out there and it's windy too. And she goes through the whole list and she's like, wait a minute here. That sounds like a lot of work to go to that fire pit. Okay, Mrs. Jones, what if we move that fire pit closer to the house? And now you can use it a lot more often. Like, what would your preparation have to look like for that? She's like, well, I just open a door and walk out and it's right there. Okay, cool. So which one do you think would be better for you? Well, obviously the one closer. Perfect. Okay. Next. Right. So I love exactly how you said it, because it's exactly how we would approach a sales conversation. It's curiosity. It's how and what questions. We try to keep the why out as much as possible, because why exactly? It kicks up that, like, well, is he judging me? Like, why do you want that fire pit all the way over there? Right. And she's like, well, because my grandkid told me that. You see how you go into the emotional, right? Well, no, logical. Let's get it down to logical. So what about that position, you know, stands out best for you, or something that affects something with a how or what? And it's amazing how well that works. And I just love the vein you were on there, because it all lines directly up to communicating anything. Even like if you're going to go out to dinner, instead of saying to your wife or your spouse, be like, why do you want to go to that restaurant? Versus what about that restaurant stands out to you, right? It sounds stupid, but it makes an incredibly big difference. I hope the listeners can hear that in my voice.
It does. And you just hit the nail on the head. What are you doing when you say, why do you want to go there? She's giving you an emotional response. If you say, what about that restaurant? What are you getting? You're getting information. Yeah. She's telling you probably in terms of her, these are the things that I find important, but she's also telling you the emotional part of it. Oh, you know, that's where we first met, remember? And I really love that. And that makes me feel good and stuff like that. So there's all kinds of things that, you know, we used to get credits like, you know, great job. You know, you talked that guy out. What we really did was listen the person out.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
The best salespeople are not the best talkers. They're the best listeners that 100%. Then develop a solution to the problem that the client is telling them that they have.
How can you possibly come up with a solution if you haven't listened to their side, right? How can you possibly understand them fully if you haven't listened to them. That was my biggest mistake when I first started that business 27 years ago, was the fact that I thought I had to come out and I was on stage and I had to then give them the result or the solution without ever listening to them, because why would they hire me if I didn't just do the thing?
Right.
Like, why listen to them? I already know what they need. They need a patio. I know exactly how I'm going to do it. I never asked her what she needed. I didn't care. What I cared about was what my solution was going to be. And I didn't realize until a lot of no's later that, you know what? What if I just listened? What if I started asking questions and actually care, first of all? Ask good questions, be curious, and not be so focused on where we're going, but what we need to get there, right? What does Mrs. Jones need to get to her backyard and to enjoy it as much as absolutely possible? That's what we're going for. If we have a goal or destination, that's where we're going. But we don't know where that's going to take us. So we need to lead with great questions. We need to lead with an open heart. Because if you go in there and say, what do you want in your backyard? I want this, this, this. All right, great. We can build it for you. Next. Right? You may get a sale, right? But you're not going to exactly, it's not going to exactly turn out the way she's going to want it, because you guys haven't had a conversation yet. But going deeper, caring about these questions, crafting them, having them set up in a certain logical order, to your point, to take you from the emotional to the logical. Bring them through, because that's where they're going to make the best decision that's going to stick. Because if you're selling on pressure and emotion, eventually that like a balloon blown up, eventually that balloon subsides later in the evening when they sit down or whatever, and they start, the logical mind kicks in. And next thing you know, they're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would I do that? Why would I spend all that money in the backyard? It makes no sense. But he made it sound like it would be the best thing ever. So if you can't get to that logical within your conversation with your client, you are leaving an incredible opportunity to serve on the table. Because they're going to go to somebody else who can.
Right. And the other thing, what you just said, is you're focusing on a sale by developing empathy, by developing trust with another individual. They're much more likely to say, you know, Gladys down the street wants her backyard done too. Hey, I know Josh. Josh was great, you know, with me. Whether you were or not, in her mind, she felt you were. Now she's going to tell Gladys. Now you may get a second sale or a third sale. So why not let other people be your marketing department and get out there and say, hey, Josh was great. You should use him. Yeah. I don't know, Josh. But Gladys used her. So I'm going to use him as well. So don't think of it as just a sale. Think of it more as your sales. I'm not much in sales. Your sales technique, I guess, how you can develop more sales just by focusing on empathy and trust with another human being.
And realizing that even with a sales strategy, one size does not fit all.
Right.
One size fits one.
Right.
Simple, right? There's a strategy, just like with negotiation. I'm sure you've got an entire strategy, if you will, a script, if you will. You take it from here to there. It's a framework. Right. Life is not in a box. So we have to be flexible in a point of like, people are going to come at you with things you don't expect. So why don't we rehearse them like you guys did, right? With the psychologist, let's go into a room and let's rehearse these things so I can find my blind spots. Let's do that in a safe environment where lives aren't on the line, so that when they are, I've burned the reps. I see the paths. I see things I didn't see before. And that's where role play is so important. That's why it's part of our sales program, is what I want to make sure you're in a safe space. You can get the objections that you aren't expecting or are expecting, but are scared to death to get. How do you manage them? How do you ask a good question, to your point earlier, and then STFU, shut the fuck up, right? Just keep your mouth shut. Because most of us want to continue to keep filling the void of no sound with sound. And it's very important, to your point, if you ask somebody a question, silence and let them answer. That's the crazy part. It's having that control of knowing that, you know what, this is Jones. So you just mentioned that your budget was $25,000. What do you hope that will cover? She's going to talk.
She is.
If you don't. And then you're going to get more information, to your point, so you can stitch together the case. We tell our students to become detectives. That's the goal. Curiosity, you want to become a detective, understand what the problem is, and then what the best solution, even if it's not you. That's where ego comes in, right? Maybe you aren't the best fit for Mrs. Jones. Maybe Mrs. Jones is better working with another company that you know of. Point her that way. Mrs. Jones's success is your success.
Yeah. I mean, we're doing this at Christmas time. You know, you think back on Miracle on 34th Street. Why was that such a successful movie? Or why, you know, in that movie, Santa's sending people to other locations. Yeah, we don't have that. They got it at a better price over there. what does that do? That drives sales to the store where Santa was because you care about me. We're developing a relationship. You're giving me the best offers, even if that best offer isn't in your store. It's somewhere else. And I think that's why sales get such a bad rap. It's like you're trying sometimes, as you say, to fit a square peg into a round hole. It's not going to work. It's absolutely not going to work. And they're not going to be happy with you. And just like we talked about, maybe that individual gives a word of mouth reference to somebody else. The same things it has. Oh, don't use Josh. You know, yeah, he didn't do a very good job for him. You may have done a great job. The backyard may look great, but for some reason, they don't feel you did. So it's so much in life is about just relationships we have with each other and caring about each other.
Yeah.
We always used to say to people we negotiate with, if you ever feel I'm lying to you, if you ever feel I'm not telling you the truth, I want you to stop whatever. If I'm in mid-sentence, say, Terry, shut up. I think you're lying to me.
Yeah.
And we never lied to people. People would say to us, Terry, I'll come out, but you got to promise me I'm not going to go to jail. And I would have to say, well, when you do come out, you are going to go to jail. And we would deflect the conversation to something more palatable. And the reason we didn't lie to people is there was a very good chance, and this happened a year from now, 2 years from now, we would be back negotiating with that person all over again, almost about the same thing we were negotiating with them now. And if they ever felt we lied to them, our credibility, our trust was gone. You were going to have to bring in another negotiator to do that negotiation.
Wow, that's true. Yeah, exactly. And how can we spin that exactly same context of that back around to our clients, right? When it comes down to it, having the tough conversations, for some, it's about budget. Other times, it's about things not going right on the project, or someone made a mistake, or I got to charge them more for something, or whatever it might be. Or they're asking for stuff that was not included in the original scope. And as owners, we don't want to deal with the conflict. So we just say, okay, yeah, no problem. We'll take care of it, because we're more afraid of the conflict than what we would lose. Yeah. From the cash flow perspective, or even the hours from our guys, or even impacting other projects, right? So my question to you is, you know, truth, as you mentioned earlier, is one of the highest levels. Like, truth is extremely important, especially in negotiation. Same thing in business, same thing in sales. Truth and being honest, number one. Now, how did you specifically build those skills to be able to be that honest, especially in those high stakes of, you know, environments? Because honesty for some is easy. It's a very slippery slope, but they're like, yeah, I want to be honest most of the time. Right. But when it's really real, when the shit hits the fan or it gets really hard, I can kind of bend that a little bit and be like, a little white lie is not that big a deal, but it is.
It is because those little white lies build. And then if you get away with it once, you know, I went to a Catholic school, so I got my knuckles wrapped a lot by those nuns, you know, with the rulers and stuff like that, when you did lie. And I guess it's just the understanding of realizing that lying really never solves anything. And I'm not smart enough to remember all the lies that I've told. So I just have to tell the truth. And it develops that trust, and trust in any relationship, you know, husband, wife, parent, child, boss, subordinate, you know, salesperson, client. That is the overarching theme of everything. If you want to be successful, people have to trust you. They're not going to give you their money. You may have the best product in the world. You may have the only product that solves their problem. But if they don't trust you, they are not going to give you their money. They're going to find a way to say no. They're going to find a way to live with that problem. Yeah. So I don't know how I did it. My parents raised us that way. You don't lie. There's no such thing as a white lie. I'm going to tell you the truth, even if that hurts. Yeah. And like I said, we would have to tell people, yeah, I know you've got a gun. You've got a hostage. Yeah, you're going to jail when you come out. Yeah. And it was like, no, you need to lie to him. No, we don't need to lie to him. And we never gave something without getting something either. People are like, you know, give me a pack of cigarettes. Give me a magazine out of your gun. I'm not giving you that. Then you're not getting the cigarettes. So again, trust is not just I lay down and you walk over me. Trust is we've got to have a mutual respect for each other. And like I said, if somebody says yes to you, but there's no how we're going to do what we just said yes to, then that's not a yes. That's not a hard yes. A hard yes is, yes, I want to build this backyard, and I'm going to pay you $10,000 now, and I'm going to pay you, you know, $10,000 halfway through and $10,000. That's okay. That's a plan. That's somebody who's willing to move forward with the project. But if somebody just kind of they're uncomfortable with what you're saying, you're browbeating them, you're bullying them, they're just going to say yes, and then they're never going to follow through with it. You've got to have the follow through if you want to have, I think, success in anything.
What's amazing, and I love that. What's amazing, Terry, is I believe it was in Never Split the Difference. They talk about false yeses. I don't know if that's something that you guys learn as well. And, you know, the idea that someone, because I've heard that 1,000 times, dude, probably more than that. I don't even want to embarrass myself. But so many times I walked away from a project with a client and I'm like, this is great. They really loved everything. And it always ended up being down to budget. Not normally the idea. But as I got older, I started listening a little better, but it normally then became a budget problem where my ideas to solve their problem was like $250,000. And for them, they had $25,000 in their mind. Right. I didn't want to have that conversation because I was scared of having that conversation, the uncomfortable one, right? So then I just like, oh yeah, I can definitely do this. They give me $1,000 for a design and I designed this thing to the nines and they look at it and they're like, yeah, that'll never happen, but it looks great. Yes, we love the juice. We can't do it now though. We got to save some money. Thanks guys. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Bye. We never see him again. So these false yeses, I'm like, why wouldn't people just fucking tell me to my face? No, it's too much. Or you didn't listen to us, or you never even got our approval for this. Like, be honest with me. No, they give me the false yeses, right? So how do we manage like the false yes?
I think if somebody says yes to you with, like I said, without anything behind that yes, it's not a yes. It's just them. It's a no in their mind. They're just saying yes to you, like you say, because they don't trust you. They didn't like your design. They don't want the conflict. Just like you don't want the conflict as the business owner. They don't want the conflict with you. So they'll say what you want to hear. And then every time you call them to set something up, they'll never answer the phone or they'll never call you back. You just leave messages. So that's, you've got to develop, if you develop trust, if you develop empathy, if they feel that you understand them and they say yes, again, if there's something after it, if they say, okay, this is, you know, can you start next Tuesday? Or I'll give you $10,000 now. If there's something that comes after the yes, then that's a real yes. If it's just yes, that's a no. That's a no in their mind. They're just saying it because they don't want to deal with you.
I love the simplicity of that too, because you're exactly right. If you don't have the client saying yes and what's next versus yes, then you know right away that, okay, it probably didn't land. They're just trying to get me off the phone or trying to get me off out of the call or whatever it might be, right? So so listeners out there, if you find yourself getting yeses, but things don't go any further, next time that happens, watch. See if the Mrs. Jones says, yes, that sounds all so great, but now what? Does she say that? Or is she like, yes, sounds good. Thank you for your time. That's a killer, right? That's not the after. It's thank you for your time. I'm like, I think I just butchered that one, right? So, oh, it's so good. But you know, it's the crazy part is when we realize this, when we can finally start seeing these things, when we become aware, underline right there, aware of ourselves and our environment more, and we can stop the emotional train wreck going on in our head, especially during like a negotiation, possibly in the beginning, not necessarily long-term, or even early in sales, you have all that. Am I doing it right? Am I saying the right things? Oh my God, does my breath stink? Are my shoes dirty? Like all this kind of stuff in your head. When you can let all that go and you can just go in because you've burned the reps, you understand every single objection that could possibly come through. And you always got to be on your feet because you never fully know, but at least you burn reps with this stuff. The next thing you know, when you go in and you sit down with Mrs. Jones and she pushes back on that $25,000 project, but you know deep down it's going to cost $100,000, you have the skills in order to move her through so she can understand from a logical point of view why it would make sense to do it this way or not. That's okay too, but at least we can come to a conclusion. And when she gives you a yes, it's not a yes, sounds good, thank you for your time, but more of a yes, so what are the next steps? Like, what do we got to do next? When can you guys come out? You know, when can you start? Like, that's what we're looking for.
And that's exactly right. There's got to be more to it. And you can't be afraid to walk away from a negotiation. I mean, 90% of the time we were successful at getting the person out safely, but 10% of the time, and this always kind of freaks people out when I say this, 10% of the time, the people's like, I'm not coming out. Yeah. I'm either going to end my life now, or I'm going to make you come in here and you're going to end my life for me. And that's a huge thing. Someone's going to die on our negotiations. And you never wanted that, but I never lost any sleep over it because I knew I worked with good people. I had good training and I did everything I possibly could to make this a successful outcome. But at the end of the day, it's kind of like what we're talking about. If you don't want to put in, you know, you may say yes to me, but at the end of the day, if there's no money, you're not setting you know, the time to do it or anything like that, that's still a no. That's still a loss. If you want to look at it that way, you can't be afraid to lose. It's like we were talking about when we first started. You've got to love the grind. You got to love what you're doing. And if you're an independent contractor, sales is part of what you do. You may make great landscapes, but if you can't talk to people, you're going to be eating ramen noodles for a long time because they're not going to, nobody's going to give you any money. Learn to communicate with people. Learn to empathize with them, to understand them. And you do that by listening and then parroting back to them what they said. Yeah. What did you just say? In your own words, just say it and then be quiet.
Yeah.
Because that develops empathy. Empathy develops trust.
I love it. I love it. And you're so right. You know, oftentimes we think about sales being, if you're a naturally born extrovert, right? Sales is easy for everybody. That's just easy to talk to. Well, I was never good at that. I'm more of an introvert when it comes to this, right? I have a certain amount of peopling I can do before I'd like to be by myself, right? So my point is, I know that about myself. And I wasn't going to let that idea that I wasn't a born socialite, you know, butterfly at a party, like that's not who I am. I'm usually the guy that talks to one or two people and I'm good. I'm ready to go home, right? How do you become really good at sales and communication when that's the play, when you're more of an introvert and you really don't love people? The way you do it is by understanding the stuff that Terry and I are talking about here, understanding a framework, and then going in and being, you know, as curious and as helpful and as guiding as you possibly can be with this, because that'll light your soul up too. You don't have to be an extrovert to be a good salesperson or to help your company grow. Because if you really hate sales, it's probably somewhere in there, because there's some kind of you don't like talking to people and you think because you're an introvert, you shouldn't be doing sales. I thought that too, until I realized I love helping people though. Even as an introvert, I still love helping people. So how can I help solve problems? And I need to do it my way though. I can't be like the ones that get on the stage and they can just yell and, or they show up and they have that charisma within 3 minutes, people just throw money at them. That's not me. It's never been me. I've had to figure out how to do this by being an introvert and then know that I have families that are relying on me to do this with it, teams and teams of people. And it's like, okay, well, the why's pretty strong. there's a lot of responsibility. So now if I can be an introvert and learn how to do this, you know, that means anybody that's an introvert can learn how to do this too, because it's not about the show. It's about truly being helpful, building trust and rapport. And I like to believe that we all have some capacity to do that.
We do. We do. You just got to, you know, even if you don't like people, we're all called to love people.
Yeah.
And, you know, you may not like them, but you should love them. And I promise you, if you love people, if you help them solve their problems, everybody will come to you. Everybody will come to you. I remember, you know, the Band of Brothers series that was done years ago. At the very end, they talk about all the different soldiers that were in that. There's a guy by the name of George Luz. And what they said, Luz was a handyman in Providence, Rhode Island. They said as a testament to his character, 1,600 people showed up at his funeral.
Wow.
Be that kind of person. Yeah. Be the kind of person that people, you did business with them, you fixed their light bulb or their light socket, or you put in something for them, a new water spigot or something like that. Those people showed up at your funeral. That's more than you just fixed a spigot or put in a light bulb. That's you connected with those people. They cared about you because they knew you cared about them.
I love it. Terry, I say this wholeheartedly. I could keep going on with you for the next 2 hours on this. I have so many more questions for you, but we're going to have to wrap it up here. So Terry, how can people find you?
So I have a blog / website called Motivational Check. Every day I put up a thought for the day. You can get access to books I recommend, videos that I recommend, my social media links. You can leave me a message. That's all at motivationalcheck.com.
I love it. And you just have, is it a new book that came out, or has this book been out a while?
Book's been out since 2020. I'm working on another one right now. I have no idea when that will be out. I'm just kind of in the first draft stage. So it's just fun for me to be doing that.
That's awesome. And the book that's out now, what's it called and what will it help people with?
Sustainable Excellence, 10 Principles to Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. It's just, I don't purport to have all the answers, but you know, as Joshua and I were just talking about, I'm old. So I've had a lot of experiences in life, and those experiences that I've learned from, I've tried to put in the book. So I really think it can help people maybe just look at things a little bit differently. And a lot of it has to do with the things that we've been talking about today.
I love it. Well, thank you, Terry, for coming on. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners that comes to mind after our conversation today?
I guess let me end with a story, if you don't mind.
Please.
I've always been a big fan of Westerns growing up. When I was young, my mom and dad used to let me stay up late, and here I'm going to date myself again, and watch Gunsmoke and Bonanza, or my favorite was Wild Wild West. 1993, the movie Tombstone came out. Most people probably saw it. It was a huge blockbuster. It starred Val Kilmer as a man by the name of John Doc Holliday and Kurt Russell as a man by the name of Wyatt Earp. Now, Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp were two living, breathing human beings who walked on the face of the earth. They're not made-up characters just for the movie. Now, Doc was called Doc because he was a dentist by trade, but pretty much Doc Holliday was a gunslinger and a card shark. And Wyatt Earp had been a lawman, some form of a lawman, almost his entire adult life. And these two men from entirely opposite backgrounds somehow come together and form this very close friendship. And at the end of the movie, Doc Holliday is dying at a sanitarium in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, which is about 3 hours from where I live. The real Doc Holliday died at that sanitarium. He's buried in the Glenwood Springs Cemetery. And Wyatt, at this point in his life, is destitute. He has no money, has no job, has no prospects for a job. So every day he comes to play cards with Doc, and the two men pass the time that way. And in this almost last scene of the movie, they're talking about what they want out of life. And Doc says, you know, when I was younger, I was in love with my cousin, but she joined a convent over the affair. But she's all I ever wanted. And then he looks at Wyatt and says, what about you, Wyatt? What do you want? And Wyatt kind of nonchalantly says, I just want to lead a normal life. And Doc looks at him and says, there's no normal. There's just life. And get on with living yours. Joshua, you and I probably know people. There's probably people out there listening to us that say, you know what? When this happens, I'll have a normal life. Or when this occurs, I'll have a successful life. Or when this happens, I'll have a sustainable life. What I'd like to leave your audience with is this. Don't wait. Don't wait for life to come to you. Get out there. Find the reason you were put on the face of this earth. Use your unique gifts and talents and live that reason. Because if you do, at the end of your life, I'm going to promise you two things. Number one, you're going to be a whole lot happier. And number two, you're going to have a whole lot more peace in your heart.
I wish I had a mic drop button here for that one. Thank you, Terry, for that. And listeners,
thank you, Joshua.
Absolutely. Listeners, I hope you got as much as I did from this episode. And Terry, thank you for everything you've shared with us here. And yeah, guys. So hopefully this landed on you this week. Remember, don't think that you're just going to wait for something to make everything all better. The grind is really where life's at. And if you don't love your grind, pick a different grind. It's not going to be, you know, the goal isn't to just that success at the top of that mountain. It's the grind up that mountain and then looking for the next mountain to grind up, because that's what fulfills our souls. That's what brings us joy. That's what brings us peace, is knowing that we can. So guys out there, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.